Good afternoon, everybody. I hope you're enjoying your lunch. There's a festive atmosphere in here, 1 week to go before Christmas. Thanks very much for being with us today. My name is Tara Joseph. I'm with Reuters here in Hong Kong and also on the Board of Governors at the FCC. Before we get going with the main event of the day, just a couple of quick housekeeping notes. First of all, I know it's a very busy time of year, but if you wouldn't mind making sure your mobile phones are switched off, especially if you have a Christmas carol ring on your phone or something that's going to drive us all crazy. Second small housekeeping note, Angie Lau, who's with Bloomberg TV, is going to have to sneak out a little bit early to make her live broadcast, so we'll excuse her quietly in the middle of the talk. And last but not least, upcoming events at the club. We're going to take a small break over Christmas, New Year, but we will be back in early January with Justice Bokhari, who will come to speak on his life at the bench and other events through the month of January. Now, on to the key event of the day, and this book, My First Trip to China, which we're celebrating the launch of today. Joining us for lunch, we've had CPO, Helmut Soman, Tom Gorman, and Frank Ching, who have all contributed to this book, along with Sir David Tang, to talk about their first visit to a country that many of us are in and out of all the time, and a reminder of the deep change that has taken place to give us their perspective of the first time they went. I don't think I need to say much more about introducing Sir David. Many of us know him and are familiar with him through years in Hong Kong and all the achievements in design, retail, and business that he's given to this city and to the world. He's going to tell us about his first visit, which was full of deep joy about nature and the lack of materialism when he first went to China, and give us his views on the future outlook of the country. Sir David?
Thank you. I was told that there was going to be a few of you, so I didn't want to risk ramble on. So I actually wrote down what I was going to say. And unlike Richard Branson, I've heard him speak about 10 times, and none of the times he ever writes anything down, and he never says anything interesting. So if he comes through Hong Kong, do not ask him to come and speak, unless you want an antidote to insomnia. Today, we Chinese in Hong Kong feel thoroughly Chinese and regard ourselves as living in part of China. Even foreign residents in Hong Kong have long forgotten about the British colony and must be very conscious of their living in a Chinese city. But not so long ago, this was not the case. I remember distinctly the first Chinese television soap, Meng Zhongyan. Cantonese speakers of a certain age will remember, or the man within a web, if we might translate it, in which a mainlander was caricatured as a country bumpkin, frowned upon as ignorant, unworldly, and awkward. It was really with contempt that Hong Kong populace regarded the mainlanders at that time, nor did it like the way the British colony was being handed back to the motherland. It's easier to forget today that when 1997 was mooted, all the tycoons were trying to persuade the British government not to return Hong Kong sovereignty to China. I was asked by a number of them specifically to lobby the Conservative government at the time, even to the point of offering and being accepted contributions to the Conservative Party. I've got photographs and records, so beware. When Geoffrey Howe, the British Foreign Secretary, came to Hong Kong to announce the inevitability of 1997, there was actually much doom and gloom, especially amongst the tycoons. Of course, precisely those tycoons who have expressed skepticism at that time are now professed and ardent patriots. I must say I find it rather irritating when I see them rather anxious in front of mainland officials, but also before foreigners of their own kind to whom they brag how magnificent China has become in the last 2 decades. whenever I have a chance, I always go up to them and ask these tycoons, well, if you think China is so magnificent, why don't you go and live there? And of course, they sort of mumble, saying, well, I don't need to. I said, well, why don't you? I can't think of anybody. I mean, I've now come across at least 10 or 20 people who exalt the virtue of China, and none of them actually go and stay there even, let alone live there. Anyway, but all that's history, and I don't really intend to dwell on it. Nor would I dwell on that very first visit of mine to China nearly 35 years ago, climbing the highest peak at the Yellow Mountain, when I felt distinctly Chinese, with an acute sense of homecoming. It really was a rather amazing feeling of belonging to a country, finally, and not being in a transient place, as I felt some of the time being in Hong Kong. I didn't realize at the time that China was actually at an absolutely critical juncture at the end of 1979. Death of Mao, whose terrible legacies of the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution were finally beginning to subside, had effectively placed China in a sort of vacuum. Well, thank God we had a Deng Xiaoping, who extraordinarily transformed the whole of the nation of China by a tiny economic experiment that was almost laughable with hindsight, that actually took place in an ugly small town across the border of Hong Kong here, called Shenzhen, with then a population of only 700,000, which has now swelled to 12 million. And in the meantime, also as ugly as ever, but in the meantime becoming a shining beacon to the economic transformation across the whole of modern China. But where do we go from here? What is the next 30 years going to bring? I hope I will still be alive, just at 88, to witness what will have happened in one generation of 60 years since my first visit. It is, I suppose, inevitable that our destiny, Hong Kong's destiny, will be totally dependent upon China's. So I might share with you some of my thoughts on the factors which will determine the next generation of China, drawing on my knowledge and experiences there from my 30 years of travels, paying hundreds of visits to all the major cities, as well as the remoter parts in the Mongolia, Xinjiang, Tibet, and along the Silk Route as far as Kashgar, where I was about 2 months ago at the livestock market on a Sunday. Very strange. And the Uyghurs, who keep their own time, by the way. So if you say, when does your son go to school? They say 8 o'clock. Well, is it 8 o'clock or 10 o'clock? And is it 8 o'clock, but it's actually 10 o'clock. So it's very confusing. Anyway, I also married in China, my first marriage in the Catholic Cathedral. I lived in a tiny flat, officially owned by a railway official who wanted a bit of extra cash, which I gave him, in order to have a bathroom. And finally, I was given my own accommodation at Peking University, where I taught and learned Putonghua. But most importantly, I draw on my own encounters with mainland farmers, urbanites, businessmen, academics, artists, housewives, pensioners, and keeping in contact with them regularly and seeing how their lives have changed, all essential for my understanding, if only as an amateur anthropologist, of a vast and complex motherland. Therefore, I'm always a bit suspicious of anyone professing to be a Chinese expert when they don't live or at least spend a great deal of time interacting with Chinese officials. When somebody says, I'm an expert in China, ask them, not how many times they've been to China, but how much time have they spent? Whom do they know? Give me their telephone numbers. And what do they do? Find out if there's a good cross-section. Last month at the Oxford Union, I spoke against the notion that the 21st century belongs to China. We trounced the proponents, 195 votes against 75. But I was accused of being unpatriotic, which is really a pathetic accusation, because by speaking about certain ugly truths, I need not have been unpatriotic at all. On the contrary, my belief is that being critical of potential problems should be a requirement of patriotism. Now, just think about China now, and I'm trying to paint you a picture of what will happen in the next 30 or 40 years, or even within the next century. Just think of the land and air and water. Now, land, there's only about 900 square meters of arable land per inhabitant. Now, that might not mean anything to you, but that is actually less than 40% of the global average. So there isn't enough arable land. And it's even more alarming that wholesale rural areas are being turned into urban cities. You will have seen a television program and have heard other huge schemes where wholesale villages are turned into concrete jungles. Air, totally polluted, appalling, as we all know. It got so bad that last summer the Chinese authorities actually asked foreign consulates to stop publishing inaccurate and unlawful data on air pollution, which was, of course, a direct reference to the quality measurements posted on Twitter by the US Embassy in Beijing, which registered descriptions such as crazy bad or beyond index. Then there's water. The over-extraction of groundwater and falling water tables are huge problems in China. Water is going to be scarce. Exploitation of dams and other irrigation infrastructures have also halted the Yellow River's natural course, threatening to dry up the entire river. Did you know that in 1997, the lower Yellow River did not flow 230 days out of the year? Therefore, just looking at the simple essential conditions of livelihood with land, air, and water, China faces enormous problems and is aggravated by her vast population of 1.3 billion and further aggravated by her demographics, which have created what someone has called a perfect storm. Now, let me explain. First, there is a terrible population explosion of the older generation. By 2030, there would be 240 million people in China aged 65 or more, even older than me, which is practically impossible, I feel, with every 4 older workers for every 3 younger ones. So the workforce in China is going to fall continually. And the smaller and greyer Chinese workforce, the growth rates of recent past are simply not going to be sustainable. Secondly, the swelling class of the senior citizen will undoubtedly place enormous economic pressures on China because they need to be fed. They're not working anymore. And then with a shrinking working force, that's going to be even more problematic. Third, because of the one-child policy, which tend to favor boys, with appalling statistics on the infanticide of girls, China have become a great imbalance between male and female. Already, there are over 120 boys for every 100 girls. This result is going to be a growing population of unmarried and, need I say, frustrated young men. And I wouldn't for a moment underestimate the frustration, which I liken to a time bomb, unless China turns incredibly homosexual, is going to be a real problem. Fourth, the one-child policy also meant that for this generation already, there are no more brothers, no sisters, no aunties, no aunts, no nephews, no nieces, which goes directly against that traditional Chinese family structure of relying heavily upon blood relatives, both at home and in business. But perhaps the most critical question on China's advancement, other than land, water, and air, and demographics, which are bad enough, rests with the leadership, or now, as we know, 7 members of the Standing Committee of the Politburo, whom we have seen, but not being able to make much out of, really. So little is known about those chosen few, how they work, how they think, how they come to their conclusions. I mean, I just wish one of them, or half of them, would actually show some feeling, or let go a little bit for 2.5 nanoseconds, so that we know that they actually have got gray cells moving in their brains, and say something that was useful. But we don't know. It all happens behind closed doors. Major decisions of state, blanket of opacity, which has not changed since the founding of the Communist Party in 1949. This has created an enormous amount of mistrust. And not surprisingly, there are continual protests all over the country on abuses of power involving bribery and corruption and social injustices. There seems to be a total disconnect between government and people. And this dysfunctionality can never be the basis of a great nation. You cannot have any great nation if there is such a disconnect between the government and its people. But what I would like most of all to highlight today is the plight of the individual in China. Far too often we have conferences and seminars and lectures and articles about China as a country, the sort of progress it has achieved, the numbers on her economic growth, the rising GDP, the diminution of poverty, rise of middle class, etc., etc. Yet seldom do we focus on the individual. It's all very well to talk about the progress of the damming of the Three Gorges, but how about the plight of a million people who have been displaced? It's all very well to talk about the great Olympic Games with the diversion of water into Beijing for the enjoyment of visitors and for the world to see. But how about the places from which the water had to come, namely Hebei and Shaanxi provinces, which had already devastated by drought and severe shortages? Even worse, none of it was required because there was no shortage. It was exactly 100 years ago when China became a republic with a promise of democracy, bringing to an end 4,000 years of dynastic rule. Maybe China needs another 100 years to secure real democracy and achieve the status of a superpower. After all, 200 years was roughly what it took America to become a superpower from an impoverished beginning. So for China, it might be another 100 years before she becomes a truly great nation. Meanwhile, to put it mildly, a lot of homework has got to be done. And I, as a sort of cockroach of 1.3 billion, would do whatever amoebic amount I can, for I am proud to be Chinese, I love China, and I'm most of all proud of the millions of compatriots who have suffered, and a lot of them having sacrificed themselves to give us the progressive and improving China in the new century of ours. Not often enough do we pay sufficient tribute to this vast body of men and women who have gone before us and effectively making us the fortunate beneficiaries of a confident nation in a modern world. I would ask that each of us contributors to this anthology dedicate our comparatively insignificant stories to all these ordinary Chinese compatriots of ours, because I think that they deserve a lot more attention than the numbers and conferences. I mean, every day I hear of conferences and I go to them and I hear boring speeches and even more tedious statistics, and never do we pay enough attention to the millions of people who have actually suffered. And I hope that we will never forget that they are the real people. Their shadows are the ones who have actually enabled us to enjoy what we have. And I hope that China will become a great nation in the 21st century, although there are many, many problems which have got to be overcome, and I can only be optimistic. I don't want to bore you further. I will be very happy to take questions after this. I hope I've made some sense. I wanted to be a bit more flippant and less serious.
A bit more, really.
But I thought I
got. You have another 20 minutes. We'll give you a chance to be really
okay,
flippant.
Well,
so we have microphones out in the audience. Please raise your hand with questions, and Sir David will answer them. Give us your name and your organization if you're with one. We'll start over there with Francis.
Yes. Thank you, Sir David. Francis Moriarty, FCC Board. I'm just wondering, in this expression of hope that you've made for the nation, what role, if any, do you think Hong Kong can actually play in making things turn out in the direction that you hope? And I suppose along with that is, how sanguine or not are you about the future of Hong Kong?
Is this working?
Yep.
We know that we can't really rely on our chief executives. We've had a couple or three who keep on telling us that ruling Hong Kong is not exactly what it seems to be, namely that we or they have to listen to China, which is a rather defeatist attitude and one which I hate listening to. But in a way, we in Hong Kong have become perhaps one of the most greatest, one of the greatest subconscious changes that Chinese citizens in the mainland have realized. If you just think in 1997, we had about 1.5 million visitors, accounting for about 25% of our number of people who visit. Today, we're almost at about 30 million, about 65%, that's 16 million. Now, just think of the tens of millions of Chinese who have come over here, from being prostitutes to young people who want to seek a greener pasture, to older men who want to come and not be followed into a porn movie, to young ladies who want to be feminists. I mean, a whole cross-section of people. And they have tasted freedom here. And I think we take it for granted about freedom that other people don't. And I can tell you that in China today, even, there is a sort of fear. And I'm afraid that I have not seen that diminish over the 30 years that I've been going back and mixing with people. There is a soft reign of terror, and you can't do this, you can't do that, and you're always looking over the shoulder. And even for us, who are used to Hong Kong, don't you feel when you're in that seat of the Dragonair, flying back into Chatlap Kok, and you suddenly feel a sigh of relief that in fact you are out of the clutches of what shouldn't make you fear or disturb you, but nonetheless that automatic feeling of a huge sigh of relief that you can come back and chuck the laundry into the basket and expect it to be clean the following day, and being able to go out and spend any sort of money you want and get drunk possibly and even smoke a cigarette you know, round the corner. So what we mustn't underestimate is that we are provided here a haven for millions of Chinese who would have seen and experienced the kind of freedom that they would want to aspire to. And that is the most we can do. We don't need to do anything else except to make sure that we don't lose that ourselves here.
In the back, orange shirt, Alex.
Yeah, I'm Alex McMillan. I'm a freelancer. So, David, I'm also worried about this ticking time bomb of the imbalance between the sexes in China. And I'm wondering, you know, what can be done about it.
Sorry, what do you say? You're worried about what?
The ticking time bomb of the imbalance of
the
sexes
time
in China. Yeah. And
the sexual experience, yes.
Yeah, well, you know, the
are you homosexual?
No.
So you're particularly worried.
Well, I can see
well,
it leading
to China. Stay up here.
I can see it leading to some serious social problems and perhaps even sort of a more warlike China, let's say, in the future. Do you agree?
I don't know. I mean, I just wouldn't like to think of a nation of, I don't know, 50 million, 100 million people who are absolutely frustrated and they can do all sorts of crazy things. But I mean, it's not a healthy, when I mean a time bomb, I don't mean necessarily, you know, people going crazy and start mowing people down or chopping people with cleavers. I'm really talking about total frustration, and it would breed a generation of discontented and people who don't feel confident, and that would be extremely sad. And you know, if you're talking about 120 to 100 already, you're probably talking about 130, even going up to 135 to 100 eventually, and that's a great number of loose men. And ugly ones, probably, because they can't get rid of the beautiful ones. I mean, what do? Very little, because we live in a visual world as well, I have to say. Probably saying something terribly incorrect, but, you know, what can we do? If you are handsome, you'll be all right. I didn't even just about make it.
If you're a handsome and you're on that Dragonair flight out of China, it seems like both your questions. Anna?
Sir David, C.Y. Lung spoke here the other day, and in a rather woolly speech, one thread kept emerging, which was he was happy that Hong Kong's populace had now reached a stage of maturity where we could see the advantages of housing over countryside. And again, reading between his lines, it seemed that he was hell-bent on concreting over most of the new territories. We know that the infrastructure of Hong Kong is geared up for actually 12 million people. Donald Jung told us that. So what dangers do we face by killing our own goose, in a way, by having too many people here and spoiling it for everybody?
Well, I mean, I don't know what's in his mind, but there's several things. Number one is, first of all, you look at the way in which land is parceled out. I mean, it's the same old five or six big companies. Whatever is offered is always costing billions. I mean, you and I can't go and bid for a plot and hope to build a small block of flats or even one flat. We have no chance. I never understood how all these agencies name Hong Kong as being one of the freest in the world. The fundamental of property, for example, doesn't tell that story. Number two, you have the rural area. You remember that it was Kwok Tat Sing who actually brought up all the letters B and actually caused a whole lot of people to emigrate to England at the time because we were eligible for British passports automatically. And it explains why there are so many Chinese takeaways in Britain, because all these farmers didn't know what to do. They could only cook the chop suey and the fried rice, and that's why that was there. But in a rural area now is compounded by the fact that Harvard is already wrapped up in concrete by Sun Yung Kai, but the other half is ruled by an oligarch of rural czars who say that they're entitled to this and entitled to that because of land rights and ancestries and so forth. And there's no way of appeasing them, but politicians are so afraid of them because they want their votes, and their votes are very important. Now, what happens to Hong Kong was the unwitting substances that happened that make Mecklehose build up effectively a welfare system of subsidized housing. There is no other place on earth like Hong Kong, which has over half of our population living in subsidized housing. So it's a good thing in a way. I think that when you say destitute people should be given a roof over their head, if it was concrete, I would say fine. But if you're going to say, let the big developers go into Sai Kung Country Park, carve Harvard out so that they can build some of these absolutely ghastly and appalling semi-detached Biju residences, which pass as palatial multi-billion dollar residences and occupied by total hollowness, then I would say absolutely not. And it is the one thing which we should all fight against. And I hope he means the former, not the latter. So I hope that he means working for the really bad and the poor, rather than for the rich.
Other questions? One for me is, and I'll come to you in a moment, is this, which you talked about at the podium, about this zeal for being politically correct when talking about China and the future of the nation. When people don't feel comfortable outside of China speaking out about their concerns or their criticisms, what sort of damage is that going to do in the long run? And how can people feel comfortable speaking out?
Well, they don't. I mean, they in fact, it's worse when they feel comfortable, when they should actually, when they close their eyes, know that they are rather disingenuous. It always makes me laugh and say, well, you know, are you going to be let in by the Chinese government? I mean, what is the Chinese government? People tell me, oh, I've been invited to China by the Chinese government. What the hell does that mean? I mean, what does it mean? And people say, I've got good connection with the Chinese government, as if somebody was actually watching over you. The truth of the matter is that But, you know, if you're unimportant enough, you'll say what you want or not say what you want. If you're unimportant enough, people wouldn't give a toss anyway. I think that at the end of the day, the communists are not stupid. They can distinguish the grease pot and the genuine constructive people. I've always believed that you can only be yourself and be honest. If you cannot be honest and you go around peddling all sorts of platitudes and just give a blanket blessing to everything that, you know, a government does, that cannot be right. So I think it's up to the individual. I would want all of you to start challenging, listening to some of the people in this town when they first of all widen their grin during the sort of, you know, some of these cocktail parties where suddenly a couple of waxworks come forth, and then telling people, you know, how well they're connected and how wonderful China's progress is. I tell you, I had an argument the other day furiously with a man who is a multi-billionaire, not that he wanted to live in China, but he says China is great because 300 million people have been lifted out of poverty in the last two decades. This is a statistic that is bandied around everywhere, everywhere you go, you know. And the fact of the matter is this, the definition of poverty is $1 per day, US, and I think it's been now upgraded to 1.25 because of inflation. But the point is that if you ask how many people labor still under $2 a day, it's exactly the same number. So, you know, that is exactly what I mean by numbers and statistics, which you really have to look into a bit more before we can understand. I can tell you that if you go into the rural areas, you will find very depressing sights, and you hear very terrible stories, more than the kind of joyful and satisfaction that a great nation would have it. So it's the individual discontentment that I worry about, not even the big economic picture. I couldn't give a toss if China became the first or the second or the third largest economy in the world and so forth. In terms of even GDP per capita, that doesn't really matter. It's only the PPP, the parity, the purchasing power parity, which actually has any sort of meaning. But talking about GDP per capita, I worked out manually the other day that if America grow at 2% compound and China grows at 5%, China cannot catch up in 75 years. That's how long it would take. So even on big numbers, we're talking a long time. But how about how we feel, how the nation feels, the individuals? That's the biggest problem.
And I think we have time for one more question.
Hi, my name is Edith Terry. And this is kind of a Shanghai Tang question. I'm a great admirer of your columns in the FT, and you're a very perceptive writer on aesthetics. In Shanghai Tang, you created an iconic Chinese brand that was based on kind of nostalgia and a pin-up desire for glamour, and all those things that those ideas and images that were circulating in China in, let's say, the 80s, late 70s, the reform era. I wonder if there's anything in the aesthetics of China today, whether it's the rebellion of these protest movements or street artists or anything going on now that kind of speaks to you in the same way. So if you were doing today's Shanghai Tang, another such brand, what would there be elements? Is there anything that would motivate you to, you know, to speak to the world that way?
It's a very long question. I think you got slightly lost yourself. I mean, obviously it can't be from protest. I mean, that would be appalling. You are probably talking about general the way in which one finds a modern city in China today, what I might copy or I might value as good enough for it to be duplicated into mainstream fashion. Is that what you're saying?
Sorry, I should just shout.
Yes or
more,
no?
More or less.
Yes, more or less. All right, no is the answer. I mean, today, China, if you go into any city, is the most depressing sort of view you see. It's like it reminds you so much of the sort of good old Soviet Union days with blocks of concrete after concrete after concrete. And the appalling thing is that it's slightly better now, but before they were all empty, because I suddenly realized that what happens is that all the units own these sort of buildings. And there's always an argument within the unit. So it's the railways or the medical hospital or the whatever it is. Yeah, and they own all these structures. And there's always an argument about who would actually live there. And then there's such intense argument that they can never agree. So all these blocks become empty. And we were just talking about any city you go into. There's that terrible stench. It was made out of soot, the coal, laundry and lard, lump them together, you've got that smell, and I can smell it round the corner, three blocks away. And while I was living in Beijing, I smelled that every morning in the fresh air, and it's very identifiable, and that isn't good. The only thing good about it is that you start pedaling faster to try to get rid of the smell, but you don't realize, as I soon realized, that the whole damn city is full of it, so you can't really get away from it. And the other great thing about living in China is precisely the cycling. Now it's all gone, and there are more cars than cycles. It's appalling. They now have rules in Beijing of not being able to use your registration on very complicated system, 1, 3, 5 on Tuesday, Friday, leap year, God knows what, and then you get fined. And of course the very rich people just have all the cars that they want and then they go on. Very stupid system. But you can't go anywhere in Beijing now without allowing for at least 2 hours. Pointless.
Well, on that note, you can get around Hong Kong quickly, and it's 2 o'clock. I know a lot of people have to get back to work. Sir David Tang, thank you very much for that refreshing, honest, and yes, it was entertaining talk and lunch. We wish you a Merry Christmas and a small gift from the club for coming to join us today.
What is it?
Oh, I don't know.
It's always a tie, which I would never wear. Let's be honest.
You can exchange it downstairs. You can have a pen if you like. Thank you very much for coming, everyone. We'll give you a bottle of wine if you prefer.
Can I just thank the FCC for inviting me? I've been a member here for many, many years. I don't spend enough time here. I love journalists. I love their indiscretions, and I love the way they behave sometimes really badly, so that I can enjoy a bit of Schadenfreude. And thank you for coming today. It's very difficult for you for anyone to get out of lunch on a Monday when the body is slightly delicate to listen to a bit of a crap, possibly, which I hope has not been. Anyway, that girl ought to be my publicist, and you should stay in Hong Kong and not go up to China.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Hang out at the bar. Seriously, you can transfer from one of our badly...